China calls for negotiation after a year of war in Ukraine. From the BBC World Service, this is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Leanna Byrne.
Reports of explosions in the Ukrainian capital as Vladimir Putin announces a special military operation in Ukraine.
The cost of this war has hit all corners of the global economy, with higher inflation, energy costs and supply chain issues. China has finally waded in, calling for talks between Russia and Ukraine and an end to the conflict. But despite a year of punishing sanctions and high-profile brands leaving Russia, its economy hasn't suffered as much as the West would like. Konstantin Gurdiev grew up in Moscow and is now professor of finance at University of Northern Colorado and Trinity College in Dublin.
Most of those companies are in the banking and financial services, and most of those companies are in the chemicals and petroleum and extraction industries. More so, when we're talking about those companies exiting, it is unclear whether the companies have exited fully insofar as their products are no longer available in the Russian markets, or they just shut down their direct subsidiaries and are now rechanneling their shipments of goods into Russian market through the indirect channels or through the distributorship channels as well. But there is some impact in terms of, for example, availability of spare parts, white goods, larger ticket items like cars as well for the consumers. Probably the most direct impact on the consumers in Russia is the restrictions on international travel that they have experienced and the dramatic increase in cost of international travel for ordinary Russians. And also, of course, inability of Russians, ordinary Russians, not businesses, but to transact using credit cards and debit cards. There is some impact on the Russian economy, much less than we think they are. And they're mostly impacts that influence the upper middle class consumption and the high income households consumption, as opposed to the ordinary Russians.
Do you think as well that this is permanently reshaping Russia's role in the global economy and its relationship with the West?
I think it certainly is altering in the long run, not just the Russian economy relations with the rest of the world, but also the overall outlook for the globalization and regionalization of trade and investment flows internationally as well. It will have a long-term effect on the United States. It will have a very long-term and adverse effect on the European Union. But then again, you know, of course, when I say beyond any doubts, I was also one of the people who was predicting a very significant adverse impact on Russia of the sanctions, which hasn't happened yet. But I do believe that in the long run, Russian economy is going to suffer a long period of stagnation driven by the outflows of human capital, driven by the lack of access to international investment markets, and crucially to international markets for innovation and new technologies.
Konstantin Gurdiev, thank you very much for joining us on Marketplace.
Thank you, Leanna. It is my pleasure.
So if this mass exodus of Western companies has been overstated, which ones remain? We sent our reporter, Johnny Tickle, to find out.
I'm now on Red Square, inside Russia's most famous and luxurious shopping mall. Before the 24th of February 2022, this beautiful 19th century building was full of both Russian and Western companies selling luxury goods. Shortly after, many of these companies chose to leave, including Gucci, Prada and Louis Vuitton. Inside the mall, their shops are yet to be replaced, but the doors are closed, all sporting the same notice, and I'm standing in front of one right now. It reads, "This store is closed due to technical problems. We apologise for the temporary inconvenience."
Just how badly affected have those companies been if they withdrew from Russia?
Not at all. In fact, the firms all benefited.
Professor Jeffrey Sonnenfeld led the team at Yale.
We have shown how powerfully they were received in financial markets for pulling out. They were rewarded because of reducing operational risk of trying to function in Russia now, in financial risk, because it's very hard without the payment systems working, but also reputation risk was quite high.
However, not all companies have shut down their operations. I'm standing now right outside Paul Smith's shop, and it looks fully stocked. And there is no sign that trading has changed at all. On the second floor of the mall, the lingerie retailer Agent Provocateur is also open. As Western pressure continues on these companies, whether it be through sanctions or simply calculating the cost of PR damage, it remains to be seen how long they can hold out. In Moscow, I'm the BBC's Johnny Tickle for Marketplace.
Paul Smith, an agent provocateur, told us their operations outside the UK are franchise models, so they don't directly operate them. Agent provocateur went on to say it should be understood that you can't just drop out of contractual arrangements without provisions lawfully allowing you to do so. And Paul Smith said, we now realise it was a mistake to allow these stores to continue trading in our name and has asked these stores to close. According to Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky, the cost of rebuilding the country could cost more than $1 trillion. So where should that money come from and how should it be spent? I asked Natali Jurescu, who was the Ukraine's finance minister when Russia annexed Crimea in 2014.
Well, I don't think it's going to be one source. I think it's important right now to start focusing in on number one, Russian confiscated and frozen assets. What needs to be done legally, internationally, domestically in each country where these assets are located to enable the use of those Russian assets, approximately $300 billion of Russian government funds, state funds have been frozen, the Central Bank of Russia funds, and approximately $30 or $40 billion of oligarch assets. I think that has to be number one. I think number two, bilateral international community is going to have to contribute, and they need to start thinking that through now. And number three, the private sector. And I think that's why the planning is so important. That's why talking about it now and focusing on it so it's not haphazard, so that we do this in a way that's actually going to work.
If you were finance minister now, what would your priorities be in terms of rebuilding? Where would you start?
For the good of the economy and the country, I would look at an accelerated demining process. I don't think we talk enough about the fact that 30% of the territory, that's two times the size basically of Austria, of the country has been mined. And if we want the country to function fully economically, if we want to return people home, we need to make it safe. Number two, I would focus on what urgent infrastructure needs and small business needs need to be satisfied to get people to come home. That's the future labor force. And third, what's the environment that I would need to attract private capital? Whether that's rule of law issues, whether that's financial infrastructure issues, what do I need to convince the private sector? How do I prepare projects? How do I identify land that's available for large-scale construction so that it's easier for private sector capital to come back into the country quickly?
If you are rebuilding, it is a chance to start again in many ways. How would you reshape the economy? Are there things that maybe you would put in place, like a greener economy, or is it really not that high in a priority list when you've got so many other things to think about?
I think it is a very high priority, and I think the Ukrainians have very clearly stated that green is key. And I think, you know, that has also a security angle. You know, being disconnected from the fossil fuels of the aggressor state, Russia, is part of both national security as well as greening. Ukraine has an opportunity to leapfrog in terms of technology. I think another element is, you know, in essence, building an economy that is connected to the European Union, connected to Europe and the Western economies. The future is looking west. The future is global trade. The future for Ukraine, both from a national security standpoint, but also an economic standpoint, is a very, very different direction than the Soviet legacy economy that it inherited.
Natali Jurescu, Ukraine's former finance minister, thanks for joining us on Marketplace.
Thank you for having me.
But of course, the rebuilding can't start until the war in Ukraine is over. That's it from the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and thank you for listening.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.